I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. Welcome, Fadi.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where are you from initially?
I'm Lebanese. I was born in Beirut, but grew up in Jordan. My family is there, and my roots are mostly there.
How old were you when you moved to Jordan?
My father moved in the very early 60s, and we followed maybe two, three times. So I was about 3-4 years old.
What was the impetus for his moving to Jordan?
My father was in the airline business, but he was a political activist, and he was involved in a political party then in Lebanon that had tried to take over government. A familiar Middle East story. I'm sorry, there's the cliche there. And then eventually, because he was part of the leadership, he was sentenced to death.
You were so young at the time, but do you remember those days of being transported?
I have vivid memory of us crossing the border by car and my sister crying. They didn't want us to leave. So you had a scuffle with my mother did with the customs people then, who ended up, because of my sister crying so much, ended up letting us go. So I have this this vision in my mind of us struggling at the border.
What did your father do in Jordan?
Well, my father comes from a relatively very poor family. My grandfather was a tram driver for the longest period of time, but he was a visionary in making sure that his 9 kids went to school. And my father was the eldest. So coming from such a background meant that you had to work harder. He left and came and studied here in NYU, by the way. He's an NYU grad from their aeronautics engineering school. He came here specifically to run away from politics. He had never seen an aircraft, and he chose aeronautics because he knew he didn't have to go to college locally because they didn't teach it, because he wanted to get away.
And did he take
a
ship here?
As a freshman, he took a ship. Took him a month. And he spent 5 years here, worked. His first job was at American Airlines in Chicago. And then family pressure brought him back.
So your father makes his way back to the Middle East. Your father befriended the king and started Royal Jordanian Airlines.
Yeah.
How did he go from being a refugee to having this stature?
At that time, the politics of the region had King Hussein aligned with certain groups, and my father's group seemed to have been aligned with him at that time. Mm-hmm. And thus, when he ended up in Jordan as a political refugee, it was a natural connection. And thus, being an aeronautics engineer, and maybe one of the first 2 or 3 aeronautics engineers in the Arab world then, so what else was he going to do? And he had helped start an airline with a friend of his in Lebanon before that. So aeronautics engineer, entrepreneur, Jordan, small country, needed an airline. And there you go.
Now, you were watching this as you were growing up. Did you have any ambitions to follow him in the airline business? Or what were your thoughts as far as a career was concerned?
You know, my memory is vague on this because maybe I didn't have any ambitions as such. I was a hyperactive kid. So my memory of myself was running around all the time, doing naughty and crazy things that scared the heck out of my mom. But I didn't think of what was I going to do in life, really. I didn't think long term. But I watched him. I watched him. I watched his political activism. He was an incredible role model. The people he connected with were extremely interesting. So we lived a fascinating life, if you want.
And you went back to Lebanon to study at the American school there.
Yes, I I'm surprised you got that. But in 1967, as you know, there was the Arab-Israeli war. We used to go to Beirut every summer for vacation out of Jordan. So, and that summer, June of 67, the war broke out. We were in Beirut vacationing. We didn't come back. So I ended up spending 3 years in boarding school in Beirut. I was actually It didn't work out for me in boarding school, so they basically kicked me out, and I went back to the family.
Well, you went to boarding school you were 10 years old.
I was a baby.
Time. Right.
Oh, my God. I still say that to myself. Independent. Believe it or not, I used to get something called gate pass, a gate pass, which means it allows me to go out of school during weekends. And at 10 years old, I would take the bus and go to my grandparents' house, which is about a 45-minute, an hour drive. So I would go to the bus station, change buses. I still remember that and say, I would never let my kids even walk in the street nowadays. Mm-hmm. But I did that. It shaped part of my character.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 when Fadi was 22 years old, and Aramex was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. You ultimately made your way to the United States, to George Washington University,
yes,
for college. Yes. What were your first impressions of the United States?
Well, I carried a heck of a lot of responsibility then because I came to the U.S. with my mom and my baby sister who had a learning disability. I was the only one driving then, so my sister went to a children's hospital, a special education program in D.C. So I had to basically wake up very early in the morning and drive her to school every single day for a full year while being a freshman and part of the swim team at GW. And my impression was the ease at 18 years. It's easy for a teenager to actually make his way around in the U.S. Most of the American students at that time were working to either support themselves or their tuition or their living. In the Middle East, unfortunately, that's unheard of. Our families provide for us until we get married and find a job. So that was fascinating for me. I was embarrassed sometimes to say that I didn't work. It was embarrassing. Your father pays for your tuition? Was like, wow. That was a standard question at that time. And it made me feel uncomfortable eventually, so I stopped talking about it.
You talk about the ease. Are you talking about even in the mundane life, like
ease,
the roads?
Like getting a driver's license. It took me nothing, you know. You did your eye exam and then you sit behind the computer, and the driving test was cakewalk, easy.
So it's ironic you say that, because we Americans do not think the DMV is easy. We think it's a logistical nightmare.
You guys need to see what happens in the rest of the world and to appreciate of what your DMV is. And then eventually renewal was via mail. That's unheard of anywhere in the world today.
It's the first time we've heard of the DMV being an example of efficiency.
Right. Well, life is, things are relative. So you need to see what happens somewhere else to appreciate what you have.
What about negative impressions of the United States when you were first here?
Negative impressions in my early days was and I'm sorry to say that, is the ignorance of world affairs and specifically of the Middle East. It was very frustrating for me, but fantastically, probably if you want to ask me what was the single most important thing that I learned in the U.S. is how to understand the causes that I care for in the Middle East and know how to argue them in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I used to think that it was a natural. We used to think that we have a just cause, and just causes sell themselves. But the reality, nothing sells itself unless you're able to argue it and argue it well and know your facts very well. So from the early days, it was also my first exposure to Jews. It was my first exposure to an argument on the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I basically had to understand democracy, understand argument, understand debate well, and knowing how to present yourself was such an essential. Again, coming from a political family, I automatically became a political activist here with the Arab Students Union, and there was, at that time it was so heated, and I looked a bit, I had a big beard and my hair was long, and I looked like a bit of a revolutionary.
Here you were in a very politicized, heated environment. What about your academic life? What did you focus on?
I went into engineering school. And then I failed miserably. I had an F in in a physics class. It didn't work out for me with engineering. I automatically changed into political science. I think it's also a very important step for me because in political science, I also got to understand the habit of reading. Mm. And that helped me a lot in my entrepreneurial life.
So you leave George Washington, you graduate, and you start Aramex out of college by accident. You met your co-founder, Bill Kingston,
yes,
in the United States.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, Bill knew my dad. So, and I stumbled into him. I think we were at the Paris Air Show. FedEx was just happening in the U.S. back then. He said, this is an interesting business. Maybe we should do something in the Middle East. Cool. Why not? I am ready. And then he arranged that I go to see the FedEx hub in Memphis. And there was a company called Purelator Courier then in the U.S. Most people don't remember it now, but it used to be bigger than FedEx, believe it or not. Obviously, these were massive for me. FedEx, aircrafts, Middle East does not fit into that. Went back to Amman to start the business.
Here you are doing all this research, going, yes, from courier company to courier, right, company in the United States.
Yes.
But you're a maverick. You seemed a little unreliable and heated.
Yeah.
Why?
I still am.
Why would Bill trust you to start this business in the Middle East?
Well, it's not a question of trust. He was basically talking to my father, not to me. A logical man would never get into this business because it's a very, very difficult business to get into because you're effectively having to build a global network from day one. I mean, that's the nature of the beast.
Right. What were the first steps that you took to build Aramex?
Well, the first steps that we took is after I looked at the study that Bill had done, we threw it in the garbage, obviously, because it was done by, an American company who tapped into research and information about the region, which still doesn't exist today. Forget about that. Threw that in the garbage. And we started researching how do you register a company. And at that time, post offices would not allow anybody to get in because they thought we were their competitors. And this was a monopolistic situation for them. The law did not allow for courier companies. But DHL and ourselves were at the forefront of actually fighting for deregulation and allowing people like us to establish the mail delivery business. We also stumbled simultaneously onto the fact that a lot of the American companies then, FedEx, UPS, Burlington, Purelator, Airborne Express, gave their packages to deliver in the Middle East. They gave them to competitors like DHL and TNT at that time. Click to us. This is where the niche is. You establish an independent network in the region to deliver packages for these guys who are not interested to be in the Middle East at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai. We'll hear more from Fadi coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. So the way you got in the door was by being a supporter of the FedExes in the Middle East. And you weren't their competitor at the time. You were seen as a partner of theirs.
This was our selling point. We said, we're independent. We'll build a network for you. We will customize. Even the word customization was not there yet. But we actually delivered for every single competitor. Aramex was their single source of delivery. They all gave us their packages in the Middle East, so they had one address in the Middle East, even though they hated each other here. We were able to answer a phone for FedEx. We had an Airborne phone, and we had an Emery phone and a Purelator phone, and we delivered on their paperwork. The FedEx brand was there through me. So for them, it was a natural. They didn't have to do anything. We had an office here in New York, and all FedEx needed to do, or Airborne, was to deliver at our JFK office, which still exists today. And from there, we took it all the way. So they didn't have to think of customs, procedures, anything. Just give it to me there, and we'll take it. And eventually, we opened an office in New York, in Paris, London, and in Hong Kong and in Singapore to do exactly the same thing for other courier companies in other parts of the world, so that nobody had to think about shipping into the Middle East because it was a bit complicated. Where's the Middle East? We didn't know. The geography was not even known then.
So you were this, you were the wholesaler and you were the courier to these couriers.
Absolutely. We were the courier of couriers, if you want, to the Middle East. So we were a known brand to the industry.
Did you know you wanted to branch out on your own after servicing FedEx and these other couriers, learning on their dime?
Yes.
At what point did you say, you know what, I want to eventually compete with these guys?
Yeah, well, I would have loved to stay doing their stuff because it was easy stuff. I didn't have to have retail operations or anything. But the reality of the matter is we knew that they will eventually go global. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Europe. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Asia. So the minute they say they're global, they, it means the Middle East. So they can do it two ways in the Middle East, either acquire us or go set up their own operation. We've had some discussions with some of them about acquisitions, but we never came to a conclusion, luckily, because the value of the company today and every day that we refused any offer increased.
What was the delta between FedEx and Airborne Express's perception of you as a reliable company in the Middle East to do their work and the reality of what you were? Like, what level of improvisation had to happen?
Oh, plenty of improvisation. So we built the business on the backs of our clients. Meaning, you know, I learned the business from Federal Express and Airborne Express. I mean, I understood my limitations very well, and I understood their power so well. And I took advantage of it to the hilt. Meaning, every time I had the chance to meet, learn, send people from my company to get trained by these guys, we did. And we did that by pushing them very hard to take our kids to get trained by them. And that's how we learned the business. I know everything that I need to know about this industry today because of FedEx and Airborne Express. They taught us the business and they paid us for it. Mm. The other thing that you need to know is their ignorance in the early days of the region, and I can say that now, led me to do things that they didn't know. Meaning, I would have claimed that I had a full network. That was not a lie, but that was not the full truth either. So, meaning, I always had somebody somewhere to deliver a package for me, but it didn't mean it was my employee. I always found someone, a taxi driver here or a travel agent there, and I would say, you know, call him and say, here's an airway bill coming to you on this airline. Please go to customs and clear it and deliver it. And say you're from Aramex. Mm. Because the reality of the matter is, as all startups are, and especially in the Middle East, we were undercapitalized. We were not sure we were going to make it. And so you needed to improvise. I was regularly taking a flight from Amman, our hub then, to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia and have packages with me.
You were the delivery boy.
I was the delivery boy. I would check into a hotel, literally check into a hotel, wake up very early next morning, grab a cab, tell him I have these 10 addresses. I would go and deliver them, deliver every package to these people, and go back in the afternoon and do my business meetings so that I can try to get my license. So, but nobody knew that then. Mm-hmm. Nobody. I would knock on these doors and say, I have this package. But I was the founder of this company delivering those packages. And that's how I learned the business.
This was in the early 1980s. If I had told you then that you would be a billion-dollar company in 2010, would you have been surprised? Or
I would have been absolutely surprised. Our market cap when we were public on NASDAQ in 1997 never exceeded $70 million. Yeah, small micro cap. $1 billion, my God, you know, at the height of this company, when we went public on the Dubai Stock Exchange, we actually hit $2 billion. And so, wow. I mean, this is incredible for us.
You mentioned FedEx. The founder of FedEx is Fred Smith.
Yes.
Did you meet him?
I met Fred Smith, and I know exactly how I met him. So I went to every single conference on the industry that could happen during those days. I was still in my 20s. So Fred Smith was a keynote speaker at one of those conferences. And I said, I have to meet this man. So right before he finished, I waited at the door. And I'm a shy man in general. And before people attacked, I came to him and said, you know, I am so-and-so and I have this small company. And then he was nice. He said, yes, nice to meet you. And from then on, I kept following him, believe it or not. Wherever he was a keynote speaker, I would follow Fred Smith and I would continue to go back and introduce myself and say, remember me? I came to see you once. So, yeah, he's without him doing it directly, he was a mentor.
Now, FedEx is one of the world's largest airlines.
Right.
At what point did you start to build an airline business behind Aramex?
We were never an airline. We're still not an airline. We are a non-asset-based company, and we have taken a decision very early on to be a non-asset-based company. One, because we didn't have the capital. Number two, because we knew it can be done without necessarily building an airline or building assets. It is about the customer experience, and that's where we focused.
Do you think if you had more access to capital in the Middle East that you might be a different company? Because if capital had been easier for you, you might have started an airline and been an asset-rich company.
Right, and luckily not. Yeah, and that's one thing that I would never, if you tell me what would you do differently, I would tell you I would certainly not look for more capital, because the biggest learning experience for us is having to do things on the very cheap, and that created an incredible amount of innovation and creativity inside the organization. We conserved. We were entrepreneurs on one side, but we understood the value of the dollar, and that is what makes us successful today.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Was there ever a turning point in the company? I mean, here you were really just scotch taping things together and improvising your way through building this company. At what point did you say, wow, you know what, we're becoming an institution?
Well, I think by the time Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, in 1990, we had reached a point of having relative stability in the network in the Middle East. Nothing fantastic, nothing fancy, but we had a nice brand with the industry. And then the war comes, and then all hell breaks loose. Kuwait is invaded and occupied. Saudi Arabia airspace was closed. 500,000 American troops on Saudi soil. Airspace in Jordan was closed. We were shut down. And then we had to respond to that crisis internally in the company and manage resources. We had employees in Kuwait then that we came driving to Jordan. FedEx withdrew then. They had some offices in the region, by the way, and said, we're shutting down. You deliver everything for us. So we felt a sense of responsibility, and we felt that even with that crisis, we didn't lay off any people then still, if you want, and we were able to scrap and manage and make sure that the company was intact, even though it was an existential issue. But we thought in crisis, when we responded and we responded together, we said, this is a company that is here to stay. As the war ended, clients appreciated this massively. And from there on, we were the company that has stayed. A lot of banks relied on us at that time. Even, you know, I remember the CEO of the Arab Bank, which is one of the largest banks, the largest bank in Jordan, calling me in the middle of the war and telling me, Fadi, we have these magnetic tapes that we need to secure, and I need them out of this country, and I need you to every single day take these magnetic tapes and take them to a country that is more secure. That was a turning point for us, and that was a turning point for our brand in the region. And from there on, we started building the business from the grassroots up.
By the way, you were married to your business. So you were growing the company. What was going on in your personal life at the time?
I was married to the business, and I was married to Rula, who is my wife. We're separated now, but she's still my wife and still a very good friend of mine and the mother of my two sons. It's a strain on family life.
You're on a plane more than 50% of your time. Do you find that enervating or energizing?
I unfortunately am, how shall I put that? I am an addict of traveling now. Which is crazy, because I feel if I spend more than a week in one place, I am stuck. And one thing I didn't want to do, like my father, was to have that constant travel. But I guess that's one habit I inherited from him. And I'm a curious person. I became much more curious as I grow and realize how little I know, and my drive to knowledge is insatiable. So I am constantly traveling. I'm constantly meeting people. I'm constantly doing things. I mean, that's my life today, and I wouldn't have any other way. I love it. I absolutely love it.
You seem to have a lot of energy. You swim every day, or you try to.
Yeah, That's something I will never compromise on. I've been swimming since as long as I remember.
What does it do for you?
It's the ultimate meditation. So people talk about, you know, yoga and breathing exercises. Swimming is the ultimate breathing exercise, because that's all you're doing. And it just clears my mind. It gives me the energy to go on. I'm disciplined in that. I'm disciplined in my food. I'm disciplined in my work. I'm disciplined in my exercise. Even though I am rebellious and here and there, but when it comes to something which I feel is a responsibility towards myself, towards my family, towards what I do, I am extremely disciplined. I have this sense of responsibility which drives me crazy sometimes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. In 1997, you decided to go public on an American stock exchange, the NASDAQ. What was the impetus for that?
We ended up wanting to do a private placement in the region to raise money from Arab capital, if you want. But we failed. We failed miserably because we were a non-asset-based company. At that time, people would ask me, do you own buildings? Do you own aircrafts? Do you own, what do you own? I said, you know, I don't own anything. We own the client experience. I'm in the package delivery business. I do it well. That's all I own. I have a network. I have strategic alliances. No, we don't own anything. We barely own our cars. So for them, you know, why would you want to value? At that time, I think we were valuing the company at around $30 or $35 million in a private placement. So where's the value then? So we failed. So Bill looks at me and says, you know what, Fadi? We're going to go to NASDAQ. And that scared the heck out of me. I said, Bill, what do you mean NASDAQ? NASDAQ, this company is owned by me and you. Nobody looks at our numbers. We barely audit our numbers. We audit them, but we barely audit them. Legally, we're like 500 different companies. There's no one structure. He said, it can be done. That was August 1996. And luckily, Bill, his biggest gift to us, he also convinced Airborne Express around the same time to give us $2 million for 9% of the company. Mm. For the first time, after talking to Airborne for 13 years, they said, okay, here's $2 million. So the biggest check I had ever seen in my life kept me sleeping for quite some time, because I had, you know, a life for an entrepreneur was managing cash flow. Other than making sure packages get delivered, I needed to every morning spend 2 hours with my chief financial officer juggling our payments, because we had such a terrible reputation for being such late payers. But that's life when you're scrapping to run a business. In any case, so Airborne buys 9% for $2 million. And then we say NASDAQ. All by January of 1997, we were on the exchange. So that was miraculous. I can't tell you. And I did the roadshow with Bill. We were only raising $7 million, believe it or not. This was a micro. 2 million of those went to the lawyers and to the banks. We were left with $5 million. And that was the first check that I ever took myself personally as an owner from the Green Shoe. So there was, you know, an oversubscription, and we ended up making, I don't know, $300,000-$400,000 extra. If you tell me what was the turning point, yes, originally what happened in the Iraq war, Iraq-Kuwait war, the reality of the matter, the biggest turning point in our life was us going on NASDAQ, because that made us a legitimate global brand in the eyes of our clients in the Middle East. Nobody had ever done it before. And the respect we got from banks, from clients, from people walking down the street who had heard about the story, until today, we're still called as Aramex, the company that was the first to go public on NASDAQ. It is a stamp on our forehead, and we're proud of it. It's a fascinating story.
It's a fascinating story, especially because you have achieved such success in such an unlikely region. What needs to change?
I'll tell you what needs to change. It needs to have a government system that has a loose safety net. In the Gulf, where there's oil money, there's a huge safety net. The citizen does not feel the urge to innovate or to create or to create his own business, because our education system starts from day one telling us that the government is going to take care of us. We are not taught the skills that entrepreneurs need to be taught. We are not told that private enterprise is legitimate. Even though the Prophet Muhammad was an entrepreneur, and he was a traveler in trade, which means he had to deal with people, and his the owner of the business was a woman, his eventual future wife. We don't teach our kids because the state is predominant in our life. So we need to change our education system. We need to legitimize and say that entrepreneurship, private enterprise, not working for government is okay, is actually good for you. Having venture capital, angel investors bet on ideas and not bet on hard assets. We love building buildings, but I don't see as many people believing in ideas and believing in entrepreneurs and thus believing in people. But it is not as arid as people think it is. The Arab world is changing very quickly. There is a huge reservoir of entrepreneurs. I'm an angel investor, as you know. I can't tell you the amount of people that come to me on a daily basis asking, showing me their business plans and asking me for either help or advice or capital.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Coming up, we'll meet Chris Barton, co-founder of Shazam. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Chris Barton, co-founder of Shazam, an app that identifies the music or TV around you simply by holding up your phone to the sound. If you're in a store and you love the sound you're hearing but do not know who sings it, Shazam will tell you the name of the artist and the song by making a digital footprint of the audio and matching it with the millions of songs in Shazam's database. Shazam started out as a text-based service before it became an app, one of the first available in the Apple App Store in 2008. Now, over 100 million people per month use the service. Chris started Shazam in 2000 with three other co-founders. He is originally from San Diego, California. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
How did you come to the idea for Shazam?
So I actually think that the fundamental idea of identifying a song was one that was very obvious to many people. And in fact, there were actually multiple startups that were trying to conquer this problem and solve it in different ways. All the startups that were attempting this in those days were doing it the way that was the easier way to do it, which is basically to monitor radio stations, and they would tell you the song. So the real breakthrough in Shazam was not the idea of identifying music. The real breakthrough was to come up with the idea of, wow, what if we could identify music just using the ambient sound in the room? And then you'd be able to do it not just for radio stations, but also in bars, clubs, theaters, TV, stores, laundromats, and so on.
Now, this was pretty clairvoyant, not only because of just the technology innovation, but this was also before iPhones and Android and all those mobile devices. We're talking, 2000.
Yeah.
Did you, at the time, envision the mobile industry innovating as fast as it had?
Yeah. I had, at that time, in 1999, when I came up with this idea, I was actually doing my MBA at the time at Berkeley. And I had spent the prior years working as a management consultant focused on the telecommunications industry. So I definitely spent time thinking analytically about telecommunications and mobile phones, and I could see the rapid rise of mobile phones. And at that time, in 1999, not everyone had a mobile phone even. as I was brainstorming business ideas, I just thought, wow, all these people are going to have mobile phones. It just seems like they're going to want to do things with it other than make phone calls. Mm-hmm. And actually, at that time in the United States, people weren't even sending text messages on the mobile phones in a big way. So I just that's really, I think, what led to me thinking about ideas related to the mobile phone. I just felt like if everyone's walking around with these devices, there's going to be other things that they're going to want to do. And the Shazam idea seemed like a great complement to that.
You mentioned texting, and that's how your service was initially launched. It was called 2580, because if you dialed 2580 and you held up the phone, then the phone would identify the song and text it to you.
What's interesting about the 2580 number, because it's sort of non-obvious to the average listener, but is that that's a short code. So when you dial 2580, it's like dialing 411 or 511. It's initiating a voice call, even though you're only dialing a few digits. And those short codes are not readily available to companies. So essentially, or to people, I mean, basically the only people that control them are the mobile phone companies themselves. And so we knew that we're going to have to go and negotiate to get a special short code for Shazam. But what's really interesting is that we had to figure out what code that would be so it would be memorable. And a brilliant designer said, well, how about the only four-digit number on the phone that's in a straight line?
Why did you choose to base the company in England?
So I have a lot of roots in the UK. My father's British. My mother's French. I have a British passport. And I loved England. I had done my master's degree at Cambridge. I've done my first job in consulting was in London. I loved the UK. And I just thought, wouldn't it be great to start a company and start it in London? I mean, everyone else is starting companies in Silicon Valley. I think it would be, as a life experience, it would be fun to do it in London.
And also, at the time, it seemed like London was more forward-thinking on mobile technology than the United States was.
It really was.
You launched the product, or 2580, in 2002. When did you get a sense that you were getting traction, that people were using the service?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, and you've hit on probably one of the most challenging parts of the Shazam experience, which is that the number of users that we had from our launch in 2002 until the advent of the iPhone App Store, which was in 2008, during that period, that our number of users were very small. It was in the sort of tens or hundreds of thousands. And so an inadequate number of users to make a viable company. And it's really only when the App Store launched that we finally hit our hockey stick of growth that we've to lead to kind of the widespread users that we have today.
Did you all talk about closing the company down before that point? Or did you feel like it could still motor along at this subdued pace?
I would say that the company came very close to being closed down several times in the period between 2000 and 2008, and it sort of just barely survived. I mean, obviously, you know, it was always trying to make it and coming up with some way to make it another 6 months, another year. I can remember when we had to switch offices our venture capital round, and normally often companies kind of upgrade to better and bigger and nicer offices, but we went the reverse path because we were struggling so much. And so we went from semi-glamorous startup offices to kind of former, you know, tax government offices and so on that were just bottom dollar prices.
Other than Apple, who were key people or key events that really helped to ensure the
success?
Yeah, or just the stability.
So one really key event is that we built a separate parallel business to Shazam in the early days. And that separate parallel business was using the same technology. But what we did is we used our technology in order to monitor thousands of radio stations and create reports around what they were playing. And that was something that was actually needed by the right societies that would distribute royalties to artists in order to do it in an effective manner, because they were doing it in non-automated ways using sampling and so on. So we were able to monetize that and even sell that piece of the business. And the cash from that was one outcome that sort of helped fund the business.
You were one of the first apps in the Apple Store. How was that arranged?
So yeah, we had a talented business development person at Shazam who was very persistent. Her name was Katie, and she was out trying to figure out, you know, who are the big partners that we should partner with. Well, it seems very obvious today, but I would actually say that, you know, although the iPhone had a lot of hype around it and it certainly was popular, it had nowhere near the scale that we have today. But she did a great job of really kind of getting to know the folks at Apple and forming a relationship. And Apple also, very importantly in that era, was trying to think about what are the third-party apps that are really going to showcase this device. Mm-hmm. They engaged with us, and got to be part of their initial launch.
You very easily, accidentally could not have been. If it hadn't been for Katie.
I think Katie is the greatest. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she spotted the opportunity early, and she was really persistent about it. And yeah, so.
By the way, it seems like creating an app is a different exercise than creating a text-based service, even though you're doing the same thing by pulling down audio data. How difficult was it building an app?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because this is in the early days of building apps.
It wasn't rocket science to build an app. Actually, Apple was very good for those early apps. They really wanted to make sure, as I said, they showcased the device as being a great device. And for the Apple iPhone to be perceived as a great device, they wanted those initial apps to be great. So they did a lot of hand-holding around a design of those app experiences.
The music database is basically a collection of songs, the names of songs, and the artists. Can you talk to me more about that?
Yeah. So basically, our goal is to make it so you can identify anything. But one of the problems is that back when we started Shazam, it wasn't a common thing to have digital music databases, and that's what we need in order to create the fingerprints that we use, mathematical descriptions of this sound. So we actually ended up having to create a database of fingerprints of music from scratch. And what that meant is that we literally had to build software where you could put CDs into a computer, and then it would fingerprint those CDs and create these fingerprints of the music. And then people would actually have to type the name of every single song and the artist. So we actually had, I think, around 15 or 20 teenagers working around the clock in multiple shifts, putting CDs into computers, typing the names of songs so that we could create this huge fingerprint database in order to launch.
And so was a large part of your capital outlay just buying CDs, like going to the music store and just buying as much as you could in the classical area and the pop area and the country area? And
We definitely invested a lot of money in creating the database, yeah. We found ways to do it where we weren't stuck with a bunch of CDs, mm-hmm. but finding a way to get to all those CDs was definitely a critical path for us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Chris Barton, co-founder of Shazam, an app that identifies the song you're listening to simply by holding up your phone to the sound. Avery Wang, one of your co-founders, was very instrumental in nailing the technology part of this. You found him through a professor at Stanford, Julia Smith, and basically asked, who's your smartest student? And he came up with Avery. Can you explain why Avery was so instrumental? If you agree.
Without him, we wouldn't have been able to start Shazam. There was no technology that could solve this problem that we were trying to solve of music recognition in a noisy environment. There were music recognition companies that worked outside of noise.
You stayed with the company until 2004. What was your reason for leaving?
The company actually, as I said, mentioned, struggled for many years, I had been there for 4 years plus, and I just thought it's time to go on and do new things. I ended up joining Google at an exciting time, about 6 months before they went public. They were still like a big startup, I just thought Shazam will be something I can stay involved in at the board level.
And so, you maintained equity?
Yeah.
Who were some of your first investors?
Well, actually, first starting off, we had angel investors for our seed round. And we decided we wanted to get prominent people that would give credibility to the company. So we had Sir Colin Southgate, who was the chairman of EMI, John Preston, who was the chairman of BMG in the UK, and so on. Phil Weiser founded Liquid Audio. For our venture round, we had three venture firms that invested in us. That was IDG Ventures Europe, and then two other venture firms, Lynx Capital Partners and FLV. We had to pitch to over 100 venture capital firms before we found anyone that was interested in risking their investment money.
How did your pitch change over time?
When we first launched Shazam, we were focused on premium SMS as our core revenue stream. So, like, literally, our model was not that different from 411, you dial a number and you get an information and you pay 50 cents for it. And similarly, we had a business model like that. You paid each time you Shazammed. We then evolved towards subscription and then later towards selling music. We were actually a big driver of music sales for iTunes. But today, the company is very focused on advertising and very innovative advertising. So not just simply putting ads within Shazam, but actually enabling people to use Shazam to connect with the offline world of advertisements around them, from TV to radio to billboards to, you know, anything.
I want to talk about your personal life. You are from San Diego, California. Your mother and father are both professors. Your mother was a professor of computer science. Your dad had a consulting business basically with the aviation industry, helping airlines determine whether there was water in the wings through NRAY, through NRAY radiography, right? NRAYs are like X-rays, except they could look through metal. Anyway, you tell me what
correct.
He did.
I'm amazed you know all that stuff. So yes, it's NRAY stands for neutron rays, and they have different capabilities than X-rays in terms of what they can provide in terms of imaging. And he focused on a project actually with the Air Force to build a nuclear reactor that enabled the use of NRAYs to inspect the wings of Air Force jets and look inside the wings where they get their honeycomb wings on the inside, honeycomb material, and look for water corrosion.
How do you think your parents would describe you growing up?
Oh, gosh, mischievous, troublemaking. A little bit.
You mean that?
Yeah, I was pretty mischievous. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would invent ways to torture my sister, for example, instead of just, you know, fighting like normal kids do. I just kind of try to come up with these innovative ways that I could kind of create a little bit of a torture environment. Like one example was that I would put her in a closet, and then I would take a phone that had a cord, and I would throw the phone in the closet with her, and then I would dial random numbers, and she would say, "Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to call." It was great.
Incidentally, where does the name Shazam come from?
Basically, Shazam is most famous for a comic series, Marvel Comics, where a small kid named Billy Babson would say Shazam, and a lightning bolt would come down from the sky, and he would turn into a superhero named Captain Marvel. But prior to that, it was used as a word here and there to basically mean to conjure magic. And so when I thought of the Shazam concept of identifying songs, it felt like you were conjuring magic to your phone.
Now, we talked before about how, you know, the traction was sort of a forced march in the early days, and it really wasn't until Apple came out with your app that there was this inflection point. Do you remember, I mean, you were at Google at the time. Do you remember kind of like hanging out on your couch and all of a sudden seeing the popularity of Shazam just escalate? Like, talk to me about those impressions.
I mean, that was incredible. I mean, it was like finally, like what I had always believed in was finally becoming a reality, and it was 8 years after the fact. Because, we came up with the Shazam concept in 2000, and the App Store launched in 2008. And I can remember they had these real-time rankings, and I have to admit, for that first week probably, I was addicted to just watching where Shazam in those rankings. Even to this day, it's actually always remained in the top 100 on the iOS App Store. I just thought, wow, you know, this is finally, the world is just discovering it. But I just was patient and waited.
Are you patient in general?
I'm very persistent in general. I'm not sure about patient, but definitely persistent.
What was some early songs that were Shazammed in the UK that you remember that kind of you hold on to as
some songs that were
First Shazammed?
Gosh, you know, I can't remember what the popular songs that were Shazammed. I do remember some of the challenging songs that we had when we were first developing the technology. This is before launch, but we noticed that no matter what people tried to identify, it would come back and say it's Brian Eno. And we couldn't figure out why. And after doing some investigation, we found it's because he had the longest song in our entire database. And it was some bug that was leading it to always conclude it was that song. And then we had another bug, which was actually much more entertaining, in my opinion, where one of our venture capitalists would try to identify many different songs. And no matter what he tried, he would get back that the answer that it's the Pixies. And we thought, this is strange because it's only happening to our venture capitalists. But what was happening is, he was so eager to make it work, this is prior to launch, that he was going up with his phone right to the speaker, and it was creating a feedback sound with a speaker, and that feedback sound is nearly identical to a Pixies song.
What are some songs lately that you've
Oh gosh,
Shazam.
I just love to always put Shazam to the test. So I always like, you know, I'm obsessed with making sure that Shazam has every song. And I really believe the importance of the long tail and the songs that don't get Shazam that much. And I really saw how for Google and for Amazon, that was a critical part of their success, was making everything searchable and everything buyable on Amazon. And so it's been one of my obsessions and something that I've pushed heavily for within Shazam and we've really achieved. So when we launched Shazam, we only had 1.6 million songs, which, to give you an idea, if you had walked into Virgin Megastore on Oxford Street in London and bought one of every single CD, you would buy about 15,000 CDs. So that'd be about 200,000-300,000 songs. Mm-hmm. So we launched with 1.6 million songs. So that was a lot of music. But today, Shazam has well over 40 million songs.
And it's still people just using their fingers to type in new songs.
No, thankfully, we've moved past that archaic form of music fingerprint ingestion. Yeah. So nowadays, there's many digitized databases. The record companies have digitized feeds and so on. So we've come a long way since then. Let's see. It looks like so. If I look back at some of my recent songs that I've Shazammed, well, this was clearly falls into the long tail because this song has only had 169 Shazams ever, which is a sign that it's a relatively unknown song. And the song is called "Flaming" by a band called Scape 11. I also have like Coldplay and Pearl Jam and you know, some big bands like that on here.
What song Prince. From Coldplay or Prince?
For the Prince song, it was 1999.
You needed to know that it was 1999?
Sometimes I don't know the names of songs, embarrassingly. Like, I knew it was Prince, but I probably didn't know the name of the song. So that's why I need Shazam.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Chris Barton, co-founder of Shazam. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Tonight I'm gonna party like it's 19.